Fearscape Media Network, exploring the unknown, one podcast at a time.
Hi, listeners.
Listen to the Books and Booze podcast with me, host Anna Timperley, and
Marlena Lear, as we crack open a bottle, or two,
or three, and dive into some interesting books, airing the first Wednesday of every month. Bye!
Hello, dear friends. I'm your head mister, Lord Stefan Gearhart.
And I am your co-mister, the man with no name, Lance Wayne.
And together we are the Misters of the... let's try it again. The Misters of the Lance!
The Misters of the Dark!
Don't shut up! Ugh, whatever. Join us wherever you stream your favorite podcasts, or go to mistersofthedark.com, where we'll be discussing all things horror, from films and books to everything in betweensies. We also have the occasional victim. I mean, guest.
Only on the Fearscape Media Network.
Shut up, Lance! I always get the last laugh.
Ladies and gentlemen, to another fantastic episode of the Convergence Enigma with Josh and Stefan. We are still in the midst of Alien Abduction April. That's right, Alien Abduction April. I am your host, Stefan Gearhart, and I am joined, as always, by the man whose face looks like a dolphin without a nose, Josh Rutledge. Yeah!
Woohoo! I would... That's my best.
Yeah,
dolphin.
You just have a giant blowhole for a face.
That's good. I mean,
it's kind.
I guess, sure. I do have a big blowhole in the fact that my nose is big and I blow from it.
So. I don't think your nose is that big.
Do you think I could blow up a balloon
with your nose or with the blowhole?
I don't know. Challenge accepted.
Ugh! Could you imagine the nastiness inside that balloon?
What if I could blow one in each nostril?
At the same time. Man, that's some serious pinching, though. Like, you gotta really, or it's gonna shoot out of there.
I gotta, like, wrap it around my nose.
All right, scientists, if you're listening, engineers, we need you.
I need your help to blow up balloons in my nose. Help.
This is serious. This is UFO related, I swear.
Like an episode of Dude Perfect.
Anyways, we are talking tonight about one of the most famous alien abductions on the planet. One of the earliest ones, even before Betty and Barney Hill, and Antonio Villa-Boas in Brazil. He was a farmer, and boy, this happened. He was abducted by aliens in 1957. We're going to be seeking answers into this one. That's for sure. For Alien Abduction April, Josh.
Yes. You could almost say it's April abduction. Maybe we abducted your April.
We have abducted I don't know. You might be trying too hard, but I follow you.
And that's the scary part.
That is, yeah, that is absolutely the scary part. Also, just a reminder, we are here on the UNX radio network here at unxnetwork.com here on the radio. As usual, every Wednesday at 8 p.m., you can find us there first and then listen to the podcast afterwards on the Fearscape Media Network at fearscapemedia.com, or simply just go to the convergenceenigma.com, and there you can check out all the episodes, even our archived episodes, even from when we were way back when we were Fearscape Paranormal Podcast, way back in the day.
What we gonna do right here is go way back. Back in the time.
No, baby. But yeah, you can go to the convergenceenigma.com/store as well. Check out the amazing t-shirts that we have. So many paranormal and just goofy and weird themed.
And it's not all t-shirts. Any of the designs you can get on mugs and
Whatever you're bags, into. Yeah, if you want a tote bag or you want a, you want an ascot. You want a Convergence Enigma ascot, go for it, man.
Yeah, I mean they're scarves. But yeah, you could use it as an ascot.
You can use it as an ascot. Big ascot. Some guy named Scott is like, hey, getting close there, pal. Getting awfully close there, pal. Anyways, let's go ahead and get moving on. Before we get into the abduction of Antonio Villaboas, let's go ahead and get to our first segment of the week, which is Psychic Word of the Week. Psychic Word of the Week.
And now, the Psychic Word of the Week.
Comes from the Encyclopedic Psychic Dictionary from Juju B. G. Blitzer, PhD, rest in peace, Honey Bear. We love you, but we never got a chance to meet you. This week, Josh, I flipped through the pages instead of picking a number. Flipped through the pages, landed on page 546, and I looked down, and the phrase that caught my eye this time was seance trumpet. Seance trumpet.
Seance trumpet. Not the same trumpets that brought down the walls of Jericho, I don't think.
No. Those were, say it is a trumpet. Say it is a trumpet. It's a trumpet. Bring the walls down. But seance trumpet here, the definition reads, a long, narrow megaphone used by etheric world intelligences during a seance to amplify their voices so that they can be heard by the physical ear, made in three tiers so that it will collapse for easy carrying. Material is lightweight, such as aluminum or heavy cardboard. The trumpet is magnetized in the sun and rain and then protected in a case when not in use, handled only by the trumpet medium. So okay, so at first I was confused there, Juju B.
So first, was I, because it sounded like they were describing something that didn't exist in this plane.
Right, that's what I thought at first as well, that it was the entities themselves that used a trumpet. But I guess it's more of the hearing aid trumpet that we saw in the like 1900s and late 1800s, yeah. that it's a receiver, not a
not a Ricola.
Exactly. No, this is so they can hear it. So I guess, boy, this must be real old school, because I have never seen seance trumpet.
Well, but I mean, it says cardboard, too. Cardboard hasn't been around that long.
Well, I think that was just, hey, we can't afford the we can't afford the other stuff.
Back when cardboard was top notch, I always found it really interesting that the grand staircase in the Titanic, the floor was linoleum, because at the time it was like linoleum was like the top notch stuff.
Sure, it's the same thing like Velcro. When Velcro first came out, holy free holies, could you imagine how expensive that was? Yeah. And now so cheap, because anybody could make it. It's so simple to make, and that's the thing. It's like once that time period, goes out, anybody can.
So bottom line, cardboard seance trumpets used to be the creme de la creme.
Yeah, exactly. Or as my friend Paul says, the creme of the creme. way to franglish that.
Yeah.
He's ridiculous, but I love him. But anyways, yeah. So, yeah, seance trumpet. If anybody out there is listening, if anybody has one of these,
yeah,
like especially one of the aluminum collapsible ones, like I just imagine a Boy Scout cup. Like that's what I imagine it to look like. If you've got one, I want to see it. Send us a picture. Also, either just post it in our social media or send it to contact@theconvergenceenigma.com. I want to see it.
Yeah, I'd like to see it too, because right now what I'm picturing is those horns that they use at like the soccer games that like were outlawed there for a while. Like
the blow horns?
Yeah. Like that the crowds were using and
yeah,
causing a distraction, but I don't think that's what it is.
Like that guy that used it and when we were in high school at all of the things where we got all the students together.
Pep rally.
Pep rally, thank you. And he got busted for it. But anyways, moving on.
I'd like to see a picture as well.
Yeah. You know, yes, we can Google it, but I'd really love to see if anyone else has heard of this or if you're someone that uses it, how effective is it? That's what I want to know. Anyways, Josh, let's go ahead and move to our next segment, which is Encounters from the Fearscape. Yeah, so we've got a longtime listener here, Becky Winterfox. Becky, thank you for all your wonderful stories on our Facebook group. If you're not a part of our Facebook group, it's for our entire network, but there is definitely focused on the paranormal for sure. But the Fearscape Media Network fan group, it's a Facebook group. She is always posting some of the most amazing stuff. She's a traveling nurse and just like, we won't hear from her for like 2 months and she'll be like, sprinkle, sprinkle, sprinkle. Here's a crazy story. So, but this is one of her most recent stories sent last month to us. And I'm glad because we don't do the encounters every episode anymore. And so I'm glad we get a chance to check this out. So check out Becky Winterfox's story.
So I'm back on the road. I'm a travel nurse after a few weeks home, post 7 months in California. I'm in Des Moines now, and I was talking with my new coworkers about paranormal experiences we've had working in healthcare. And trust me, we all have stories. Once we had two patients die in one night. One was expected, as I care for hospice patients as well as acute skilled, and one was not. It was extremely active, needless to say. So we all started sharing our experiences, and I shared one that has always brought me to tears. Back in 2013, I was training a brand new graduate nurse on end-of-life care. We had a gentleman that we all adored who was actively transitioning. It was apparent he would be making his journey very soon, so we checked him over, talked with him, and stepped out to the nurse's station. Before we reached it, though, his door slammed shut. The new nurse, let's just call her Mary, jumped and took about 5 steps back. I looked at her, and the fear in her eyes was inexplicable. I told her to calm down, that this was common in end-of-life situations. I told her we needed to check on our patient because if I can help it, no one begins their journey alone. At first, she refused. So I talked with her and explained that there's just some things we can't explain. But right then, our patient needed us. And so we walked back towards his room with her still several steps behind me. I knocked on the door. I announced myself and slowly opened it. As I rounded the corner toward his bed, an elderly woman dressed in a floral print muumuu stood beside him, holding his hand and stroking his hair. Mary said she must have come in when we were headed to the nurse's station, as we had not seen her. But I knew better. The woman turned and looked at us, smiled, and then shooed us away. I took Mary's hand and told her we were leaving. She had this confused look on her face and didn't move, and I literally dragged her out of the room, telling her it was time and we did not belong there. We waited about 10 minutes, and I told her we needed to go back into his room and see how he was doing. because I already knew, but I didn't want to scare her any more than she already was. She asked me why, especially since he had company. So I told her that he didn't have company, that he was already gone. She really did not want to go back in after I said that. But we knocked. We announced ourselves, and we entered the room. He lay there still, peaceful and smiling, with his hand laid out as if he were holding someone's hand. He was gone. And I told Mary about to open the window. We still do that, and I still teach that. And we began our aftercare of our patient. I heard Mary suck in her breath, and she was pointing at his bedside table. And there was a double frame with one side, a photo of an elderly woman in a floral print muumuu, and the other, her death notice from 3 years earlier. It was his wife. It took a while for Mary to calm down and process what she'd just experienced. We talked it over for the rest of the shift, and from then on, each time one of her patients was close to their journey, she would call me to be with her. She never really got used to it, but she learned to accept it and be a positive part of the process. See, most deaths I've attended are beautiful and peaceful, and this one was just beyond exceptional, and I felt very honored to have been a part of this experience.
Thank you, Becky.
Yeah, I remember reading it and getting cold chills, and then listening to you here, it still gave me chills. Just the thinking about the reverence of the occasion, and the situational awareness of Becky to know when it was time to leave. Right?
I would love for her and my sister to work together, man, because my sister, who is also a nurse, not a travel nurse, but a behavioral health nurse, but she still deals with patients who pass on and things like that. And I would love for them to meet up and just be a fly on the wall for that conversation.
Yeah. Here, wear this lapel mic.
Yeah. Could you guys go get coffee, but wear this lapel mic? Thanks. But no, thank you, Becky, as always, for sending those. And you guys can always post those on our social media or in the Fearscape Media Network fan group, your own stories, your own encounters or experiences, or just send those to contact at theconvergenceenigma.com, or even on theconvergenceenigma.com. You can submit a sighting if you want to, and just send it to us there. However you want to do it, if you've got them, send them to us. We yeah. love these stories.
Love to hear them.
Love them. But Josh, let's go ahead and move on to our topic tonight. Antonio Villa Boas.
Yeah, Antonio Villa Boas.
April is alien abduction month. It's abduction April, alien month, alien abduction, alien, right?
It's amazing. yeah, so this actually happened, like you said, back in 1957.
1957. Oh my God. 1907.
The actual abduction happened on October 15th, 1957, but the strange encounters actually began 10 days earlier than that.
Okay. Okay.
So Antonio is 23 years old. He has a brother, and they work, they have a farm, a couple of farms and some plantations that they work in the evening hours to avoid the heat of the day. So a little after 11 p.m. on October 5th, Boas spotted a bright white light in the sky as he opened the window to get some air. Later that night, after sleeping for a while, he awoke and looked again to find that same light still there, moving toward him as he looked at it. Frightened, he slammed the shutters, waking his brother, who watched the same astonishment as the bright light played through the shutters a while before leaving. On the 14th, around 9 to 10 p.m., Boas and again his brother were out tilling the fields when they both witnessed an extremely bright light a little over 300 feet above their heads. Boas, leaving his brother behind, went to investigate, And as he got closer, it suddenly darted away at tremendous speed to the opposite end of the field.
And 300 feet's closer than you think.
Yeah.
I mean, that's much closer than you think.
You figure like a tall pine tree is probably like maybe 100 to 125 feet. So, mm-hmm. I mean, it's maybe two trees, you know, two or three trees stacked on top of each other. That's still pretty close.
Yeah.
But he approached it again, and again, it darted away back to where it had started from. This maneuver repeated no less than 20 times.
Jeez.
At last, with Boas discouraged, he just returned back to his brother. Boas said that the light kept still for a few moments longer in the distance. Now and again, it seemed to throw forth rays in all directions, the same as like the setting sun. Then it suddenly disappeared as if it had been turned off.
Hmm.
He says that I am not quite sure if this is what actually happened, for I cannot remember if I kept looking in the same direction all the time. Maybe for a few seconds I glanced elsewhere, so it may have lifted up and disappeared before I had time to look back again.
Interesting.
So the next night, after, so you got, this has now happened twice, right? Two nights.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, I mean, this is already pretty rare.
Yep. So the next night, he decided to work the fields alone, which I can't say that was a wise choice, but, you know.
To each their own, man. Yep. To each their own.
When he was at the same spot that he and his brother had witnessed the light the night before, he saw a reddish light in the sky, which zoomed toward him at remarkable speed. And this is a quote, so quickly that it was on top of me before I could make up my mind what to do about it. About 160 feet above his head, it stopped suddenly. This light was so intense that he couldn't see the tractor's headlights. And it was 1 a.m. Boas said it looked like a large elongated egg.
I wonder if this is the first egg-shaped UFO sighting. Because, and we'll cover this in some of my contactees episode, but they definitely saw some egg-shaped ones.
Yeah, and I think when we talk about the Pascagoula case, I think they may have described it as being egg-shaped as well. Mm-hmm. So
interesting theme we accidentally had.
Yeah, exactly. So the with several technical features about it, three legs extended from beneath it. And as it settled to the land, Antonio took off running to his tractor in terror.
Right. Now that sounds like War of the Worlds.
Yeah. He said when he reached it, the tractor and its lights died, making his escape out the other side and running towards the house. His arm was grabbed by a small figure. He says it only reached to about his shoulder in strange clothes, which he violently shoved away. Three more small figures surrounded him and lifted him off the ground by the arms.
That's scary, man.
So now
this is already in distinct contrast to the alien sightings of the 1950s.
Yes. But I think a lot of what we've seen or covered or have seen covered of the alien sightings of the 1950s, a lot of them were very U.S. centric.
Mm-hmm.
This obviously happened in Brazil. So,
yep.
Different experience. So Antonio described these creatures in great detail once he got into the craft. He said all of them wore a very tight fitting suit made of soft, thick, unevenly striped gray material. This garment reached right up to their necks, where it was joined to a kind of helmet made of a gray material that looked stiffer and was strengthened back at nose level. Their helmets hide everything except their eyes, which were protected by two round glasses, like the lenses in ordinary glasses. Through them, the men looked at me, and their eyes seemed to be much smaller than ours.
Yeah.
Though I believe that they may have been the effect of the lenses. All of them had light-colored eyes. They looked blue to me, but this I cannot vouch for.
Yeah. And I know, I already know, and I'm sure we'll get into some skepticism and things like that, but how much some people say it sounds like the day the earth stood still, you know, yeah. and stuff like that.
It does say here that above their eyes, the helmets looked so tall that they corresponded to what the double the size of a normal head would be. Probably there was something else hidden underneath those helmets placed on top of their heads, but nothing could be seen from the outside.
Yeah.
Right on top, from the middle of their heads, were sprouted three round silvery metal tubes. It says here, I can't tell whether they were made of metal or rubber, which were a little narrower than a common garden hose. The tubes, which were placed one in the middle and one on each side of their heads, were smooth and bent backward and downward toward the back.
Hmm.
There they fitted into their clothes, but one went down to the center where their backbone is, and the other two, one on each side, fitted underneath the shoulders at about 4 inches from the armpits.
Right. And again, I mean, he's describing something that was not in pop culture, right?
Right.
So if this is something he's legit seen, he's describing it with his own experience. And being a farmer, I mean, he may already have less experience. I'm sure he doesn't have a TV at that point. You know, it's Brazil. You know, hell, most Americans didn't have it.
Have a TV, right? Yeah, at that time, right?
Right.
So he said he didn't notice anything, no hump or lump to show where the tubes were attached. Nor any box or contrivance hidden underneath their clothes.
Mm.
So, you know, it's like if the tubes are providing air or oxygen or something,
right.
There was no indication that they went into a device or a mechanism to do that.
Right.
Their sleeves were narrow and tight fitting to the wrists, where they were followed by thick five-fingered gloves of the same color that must have somewhat hindered their movements.
Okay, well, that's interesting.
It says, as to this, I noticed that the men weren't able to double their fingers together so as to touch the palms of their hands with the tips of their fingers. The difficulty did not prevent them from catching and holding me firmly, nor from deftly manipulating the rubber tubes for extracting my blood.
Hmm.
Those overalls must have been a kind of uniform, for all the members of the crew wore a red badge, the size right. of a pineapple slice, on their chests.
Yep, that's the one thing that I remember from this, is that big red badge.
Yeah. And it says that sometimes it reflected a shiny light. Not a light of its own, but reflections such as those given by rear lights of a car when another car lights it up from behind.
Mm-hmm.
It says from the center badge, there came a strip of silvery metal, which joined onto a broad, tight-fitting claspless belt, the color of which I can't remember. So this is like a sash, right? That's
right,
what he's describing
right.
here. No pocket could be seen anywhere, and I don't remember seeing any buttons either. The trousers were also tight fitting over the buttocks, thighs, and legs.
Buttocks.
And their buttocks. And there was not a wrinkle nor a crease to be seen.
That's something that is a popular thing as well, which tells you it's some sort of material that we you know, we're not huge on yet. I mean, hell, I don't
spandex,
polyester, you know, I don't know when polyester
became a thing. I'm looking that up right now. But, you know.
Yep.
Something along those lines.
Yes. I mean, they're always described as wearing tight fitting uniforms. I mean, even in the Travis Walton case,
right?
You know, he describes them as wearing tight fitting coveralls. So, right. I mean, it's always a, you know, it's funny that they're all like in movies and stuff. Even the grays are always portrayed as being naked.
Right.
But they're never described that way.
Right. Never. Yeah. It's really, really interesting. You know, and we've said this before. What if that is their spacesuit?
Yeah. Well, and I mean, the fact that, you know, what if, you know, what killed off a lot of indigenous people in the Americas when the Europeans came, right, was mm-hmm. disease. Because they brought diseases that the indigenous people here in the Americas had never experienced before. So it stands to reason that either A, they could have disease that we have never seen before, or B, we have disease that they've never seen before. So that sense for them to protect themselves.
Yeah, I mean, that's what War of the Worlds is all about. That's how we end up defeating the aliens. Spoiler alert is the common cold.
Yeah. Not so common anymore. Anyways, it says that there was no visible hem between the trousers and shoes. Which were actually a continuation of the former being part of the same garment. It also reminds me a lot of what our astronauts wear into space.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's just kind of one big, what appears to be seamless unit because of the way that they fit everything together and it locks into place to create an airtight environment inside the suit. That's what it reminds me of. So,
yeah, absolutely.
And obviously in 1957, there were no astronaut suits to be seen anywhere.
So. Just a Sputnik suit.
So they were their soles of their shoes were different from ours. They were thick, about 2 or 3 inches thick.
And a little. So they already had platform shoes. They were going to go disco dancing later that evening.
Hey, they probably got, you know, Napoleon syndrome like Tom Cruise and have to wear platform shoes.
Lifts.
And it says that they were a little turned up or arched up in the front.
Oh, what they were turned. They were turned up.
Well, you know what that reminds me of? Hmm. Is how like elf shoes are always kind of presented. Like kind of turned up in the front. So it's like, again, here there's like a callback to... to fairy folklore.
Yep.
So,
I was about to say the same thing. Yep.
So it says here that the tips look like those. Well, actually, so it goes on in the article that I found. It says just the tips look like those described in fairy tales of old, though the general appearance was that of a common tennis shoe.
Hmm.
Which are not Nikes in 1957.
No. Some PF Flyers.
Yeah. back when I remember I bought or my mom bought me a pair of kangaroo shoes.
Oh yeah, with a little pocket.
The pocket on the side.
Heck yeah, dude. That's where I stored all my ice cream truck money.
But anyways, it says here that from what I saw later, they must have fitted loosely. For they were larger than the feet they covered. So the shoes were bigger than their feet. You know what they say with extraterrestrials with big shoes.
I wasn't going to say it, but I'm glad you did.
Yeah. It says, in spite of this, the men's gait was free and easy. And their movements were swift. Perhaps the closed suit they wore did interfere slightly with their movements because they kept walking very stiffly. They were all about my height, so 1.64 meters. So what is that? Like 1 meter is 3.5 feet or something like that.
Yeah,
so
around
one and
that,
a half is around 5 feet tall, let's say, mm-hmm. In shoes. Perhaps a little shorter because of the helmets, except for one of them, The one who had caught hold of me out there, this one did not even reach my chin. All seemed strong, but not so strong that I had fought one of them, and one time I should have been afraid of losing. I believe that in a free-for-all fight, I could face any single one of them on an equal base. Hmm. It says here, it's interesting to note the similarities between Boas's descriptions of the creature's clothing and that of fairies. The unevenly striped uniforms sound not unlike the sort party-colored clothing design one might expect on an elf, or perhaps even an evil jester.
Yep, that's what I was going to say.
Even with bent hoses sticking out of their head like tassel bells on jester caps.
Or like a darrow or tarot. Yep. I mean, a darrow, sorry.
Yeah, darrow. Well, there's a book out there that has a conversation back and forth between Ray Palmer and mm-hmm. Richard Shaver in a series of letters. And in one of the letters, it says Shaver's writing to Palmer and he says, "Hey, you represented the Darrow wrong. They look just like us. They are walking around amongst us all the time." And so, even the long noses and stuff that Ray Palmer presented them as was not correct, according to Shaver. So
thanks, Ray Palmer.
Yep. Also, one last call out. If anybody out there has the original Shaver manuscript, if it's a PDF copy,
yeah, I don't care if you're taking pictures with an old Kodak. Send us all them pictures.
Yeah, I don't know if it's a series of Polaroids that you mailed to me. I don't care. But so at this point, while resisting as best he could, Boaz found himself being pulled up a flexible metallic rolling ladder into a hatchway, which closed behind him. It was so neatly closed that no seam was visible to the naked eye. He found himself...
Is another commonality.
Yep, very much so. Almost organic in nature. Mm-hmm. He found himself inside a small square room. No furnishings. It was brightly lit. He describes it as the same as broad daylight. It was brightly lit by recessed square lights and the smooth metallic walls.
Interesting.
So suddenly an opening appeared from the seamless wall and Boaz was led into another room. The only furnishings visible was an oddly shaped table that stood at one side of the room, surrounded by several backless swivel chairs, something like bar stools.
Feel like it's like those chairs from Men in Black, the movie that he sits into, and he doesn't know how to sit in it.
Well, that's where the egg shape came from, right?
Right.
So. they were all made of the same white metal, the same kind of awesome. The table, as well as the stools, were one-legged, narrowing toward the floor. Where they were either fixed, such as the table, to it, or linked to a movable ring held fast by three hinges jutting out of each side of a and riveted to the floor.
See, now that's the thing that, you know, the skeptics will bring up a lot. Like, you know, how when Woody Derenberger, when he was on his ship, how he saw things that were very 1960s on that ship, right?
Right.
And now this is a little bit different. These are very futuristic in a sense, but they're still common things like chairs. And, you know, that's the thing I always think about when I think about an alien species. Would they wear shoes? Would they wear clothes? Would they sit down in a chair with a back on it? Right. If they're humanoids.
I mean, so there's part of me that says that, this is probably very rudimentary, but they're walking around, right? They're not floating around when they're inside their spaceships, right? So there's some semblance of gravity. And so anytime there's a semblance of gravity, you feel weight. That's what weight is, right? It's an expression of gravity. So if you feel weight, you're not going to want to stay in forever.
Right.
you're going to want to sit down eventually. I mean, even from a, just a comfort perspective.
Right. And if they're humanoids like us and they have legs and buttocks and joints and that move the same as ours, then yeah, it should be assumed that their chairs would be similar.
Right. You know, if they've got a tail, there'd be a hole in the back for their tail to stick out.
Like our elementary school chairs.
Yeah, exactly.
Has that triangle for the devil's tails to come out.
Right. That's what it is.
That's what our nun always used to tell us it was there for, was for our little devil tails to go out through them.
Really, it was for when you tooted in class, you could let it just kind of scoot out the back. So
high class entertainment here on the Convergence with Josh and stuff.
Hey, I said toot.
You did.
That says that his abductors then grabbed and held him in place while communicating in sounds that had no resemblance whatsoever to human speech. He says, I can only think of no attempt to describe these sounds. So different were they from anything I've ever heard before. These sounds still make me shiver when I think of them. It isn't even possible for me to reproduce them. My vocal organs are not made for it. He compares the sounds to animal grunts. That should be, I know we've talked about that before with other cases. Some longer, others shorter, sometimes containing several different sounds at the same time, and other times ending in a tremor.
Yeah.
Curiously, these creatures then began undressing him, despite his constant opposition. They obviously couldn't understand me, but they stopped and stared at me as if trying to make me understand that they were being polite. Which is, what was the case? Oh, I think it was the Travis Walton case, where he kind of like lashed out at them and they kind of stopped what they were doing and just kind of stared at him and then left the room. So,
yeah. They're just looking at him like, well, this isn't
what?
Supposed to
what
happen.
Are you doing, bro? besides that, they had to employ force. They never at any time hurt me badly, and they did not even tear my clothes, with the exception of my shirt, perhaps. Once he was stripped naked, they rubbed him all over with a thick, clear, odorless liquid.
It's called oil.
Or hand sanitizer.
Or, oh, maybe.
And then he was prompted into another room with red inscriptions over the door, like scribbles of a kind entirely unknown to us, is what he said. Mm. He would later say that soon two of the figures joined him, carrying apparatuses that looked like some blood. They took some blood from his chin, leaving small scars that were later noticed by the doctors at the hospital, and that they caused him no pain and minimal discomfort. Next up is the succubus.
Distinct move here.
Yep. So Boas says that he was left alone for about an hour and made himself comfortable on a large, featureless, foam rubber-like gray bed or couch in the middle of the room. It had no legs. So it's like a giant beanbag.
Right.
That's the way I think of it.
Yeah.
From holes in the wall, from about the height of his head, came tufts of gray smoke that quickly dissolved. At first, Boas felt nauseated, as though he was being suffocated. Then he rushed to one corner of the room and vomited. And after that, his breathing was easier. This makes me think that they were conditioning the room for the entity coming in to be able to breathe.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's something where, you know, like, you know, 78% of our atmosphere is nitrogen.
Yeah.
Well, maybe they can only stand 56% of the air being nitrogen. But for us, it's okay because we don't breathe nitrogen.
Right.
So, you know, they did something to change the composition of the air so that they could breathe and we could still breathe and you know, whatever. So it says here that a little while later, a door opened and in walked a naked woman.
Ooh, yeah.
Now, Boas did speculate that the clear liquid was an aphrodisiac. And, you know, the one of the investigators says that it was probably a germicide of some kind, which is, I don't know, I said the hand sanitizer.
Right.
So she came in slowly, unhurriedly, perhaps a little amused at the amazement she saw written on my face.
This very much starts, to me, at this point, starts feeling like David Huggins' story.
Yeah, very much so. It says, I stared open mouthed. She was beautiful, though of a different type of beauty compared with that of the women I have known. Her hair was blonde, nearly white, like hair dyed with peroxide. It was smooth, not very thick, with a part in the center, and she had big blue eyes. This is also reminiscent of David Huggins. Rather longer than round, for they were slanted outward, also David Huggins. Mm-hmm. He says it's like those pencil drawn girls made to look like Arabian princesses that look as if they were slit, except that they were natural. There was no makeup. Her nose was straight, not pointed, not turned up, nor too big. The contour of her face was different, though, because she had very high, prominent cheekbones, also David Huggins, that made her face narrowed to a peak, so that all of a sudden it ended in a very pointed chin, which gave her the lower part of her face look very pointed. Man, this sounds exactly like the description from David Huggins.
Yeah.
Except the only difference is that his female had black hair. That's the only difference that I've seen so far. Her lips were very thin, nearly invisible, in fact. Her ears, which I only saw later, were small. It did not seem different from ordinary ears. Her high cheekbones gave one the impression that there was a broken bone somewhere underneath. But I discovered later they were soft and fleshy to the touch.
Hmm.
So they did not seem to be made of bone.
Right.
Her body was much more beautiful than any I had ever seen before. It was slim, and her breasts stood up high and well separated.
Makes you wonder, and, you know, I'm not trying to be goofy or anything, but if it's similar to a penis, right? Like where blood canned thicken the skin around to make it hard,
or cartilage, like in your
cartilage,
nose,
right?
Or
yeah,
your ears, you know. So, her it says her waistline was thin, her belly was flat, her hips well developed, and her thighs were large. Her feet were small, her hands long and narrow, her fingers and nails were normal. She was much shorter than I am. Her head only reached my shoulder. Her skin was white, as that of our fair women here. She was full of freckles on her arms. I didn't notice any perfume except for a natural female odor. And another thing I noticed was that the hair in her armpits was bright red, nearly the color of blood.
That is definitely interesting.
It says here that also noticed that her pubic hair was also bright red.
Well, I mean, so not to stop you, but, you know, when you get into red hair and blonde hair and things like that, you get into this idea of that Caucasian gene, especially the milky skin, the red hair, the ones that are the most minority of the hair colors and eye colors and things like that. But there are people that do that. They wonder if these are the talls, right? These are the, even though she was short,
yeah.
You know, that's our DNA of the folks that have those things. Did that come from the stars?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's a very good question. And I mean, I think that's what, not to make this episode Nazi related, but I mean, that's where like Hitler and all his cronies were all about is somehow there was some kind of a bloodline that they, you know, that was from the stars or whatever.
Or from Atlantis or whatever.
Yeah. So, but Boaz goes on to recount that the woman came toward him in silence, looking at me all the while as if she wanted something from me. Pressing herself to him, he understood what her purpose was. I began to get excited. I ended up forgetting everything and held the woman close to me, corresponding to her favors and greater ones of my own. Apparently, they had two sexual encounters and performed a variety of acts together for about an hour, after which the woman pulled away to leave. All they wanted was a good stallion to improve their stock, Boaz said. which is also very reminiscent of the David Huggins case. Yep. So he said that he enjoyed the encounter, even if the woman refused to kiss. It is note here that, you know, he had just thrown up, so maybe the woman didn't want to kiss him for another reason. Instead, it said the woman preferred to bite his chin while making sounds that Boaz, in Boaz's mind, sounded like animal growls.
There we go again.
Yep. He said she never spoke. When they were finished, one of the other creatures entered and called out to the woman. But before leaving, she pointed to her belly and smilingly pointed to the sky southward, I should say. Then she went away. I interpreted the sign as to mean that she intended to return and take me with her to wherever it was she lived. He seemed to be concerned or even afraid about the last, for he took the meeting quite seriously and wasn't sure if he was anxious to leave his familiar surrounding or his family.
Interesting.
After fetching the woman, the creature returned Boaz's clothes. He was led back to the room with the stools and the table where the crew sat and communicated with each other in their strange kind of ignoring or language, ignoring him altogether. He felt calm, for I knew no harm would come to me, is what he said. Now he had a chance to take stock of his surroundings. He tried to remember all he could. He noticed that the walls were smooth, metal, and hard, with no windows anywhere. Noticing a box with a glass top that had the appearance of an alarm clock. He attempted to conceal it. Noticing this, one of the crew seized it instantly and shoved him back. Interesting here, it says Jacques Vallée said that Boaz described the clock as having one hand and several marks that would correspond to the 3, 6, 9, and 12 of an ordinary clock. However, although time passed, the hand did not move. And so Antonio concluded it was not a clock.
I wonder what it was then.
I don't know. This is also from Vallée. It says the symbolism in this remark by Boaz is clear. We are reminded of the fairy tales of the crunchy country where time does not pass, and of that great poet who had in his room a huge white clock without hands bearing the word, "It is later than you think."
Yep.
The creatures continued to lead him through the ship, pointing out various interesting features, which Boaz described at length with a remarkable amount of detail. Boaz stressed that there was no doubt in his mind whatsoever that he was aboard a metal craft. The tour was finally over. One of the figures gestured him down the ladder, then pointed to itself, to the ground, and then in a southerly direction in the sky, the same direction the woman had pointed. Boaz was signaled to step back, and the ladder retracted, and the ship rose. The tripod landing struts retracted once again, so smoothly that once in place, no sign of the opening through which they had emerged was visible. It stopped a little over 100 feet above his head. It grew increasingly brighter a buzz formed by the dislocation of the air grew louder, and the revolving saucer began to rotate at a terrific speed, while the light turned to many shades of color, finally settled on a bright red. As this happened, the machine abruptly changed direction by turning unexpectedly and producing a large noise, a kind of shock. When this was over, the strange ship darted off suddenly like a bullet southward, holding itself slightly askew at such a speed that it disappeared from sight in a few seconds.
Shoo.
It was about 5:30 in the morning when Boaz returned to his tractor. So you recall that when this all started, it was about 1 a.m. Mm-hmm. So 4.5 hours. He discovered that the tractor had been sabotaged, that the abductors had knowledge of tractor, how tractor works, and so the battery wires had been detached. It says here, for about 3 months after his encounter, Boaz suffered various mild medical ailments, such as pains throughout the body, nausea, headaches, loss of appetite.
Kind of like Barney Hill.
Yep. Ceaselessly burning sensations in the eyes. That's what Kiel described as the cosmic clap,
yep.
Right?
Yep.
Cutaneous lesions at the slightest of light. Which went on appearing for months, looking like small reddish nodules, harder than the skin around them and protuberant, painful when touched, each with a small center orifice yielding a yellowish, thin, waterous discharge.
Right.
The skin surrounding the wounds presented a hypochromatic, violet-tinged area. So, that is the Antonio Boaz abduction case.
Now, again, I have to say what's remarkable about this is that there was no anything like this before it.
Right.
There was no, hey, well, we can look back and say Travis Walton saw the movie version of Betty and Barney Hill and had this guy had no.
Right.
I mean, there were abduction experiences in the late 1800s and some things like that, but nothing like this.
Well,
and to include the sexual hybridity of it all, yeah. I just made that word up, but to add that aspect to it, right?
Yeah.
It's a game changer in UFO abductions and alien abduction stories.
Yeah. I mean, and this definitely does, we called it out several times throughout, but I mean, the idea there that, you know, they just needed somebody who could give them good genetic material, right? Mm-hmm. To further their race. And it almost makes you feel like, or almost makes you question, if the things that happened in the two occurrences prior to the abduction were like some sort of physical stamina test, right?
Yeah.
It tested his ability to track and logically comprehend the light in the sky. Then it tested his endurance by making him run from one side of the field to the other 20 times. It was like a physical exam was occurring, and then like, oh, yep, this one's good. Let's go ahead and get this one going.
Yeah.
You know?
And, you know, he never faltered on his story. He died in 1991, in January 1991, and he stuck by the story of his abduction for his entire life. You know, he didn't have some deathbed confessional or anything like that. And then he has his own Mandela effect here, that there are many sources that say he died in 92 when in fact he died in 91, right? It'd be different if it was in December and it was close to the end of the year, but no, he died in January of 1991. Yeah. So very odd stuff, but it's amazing how, even though this took place in Brazil, you know, the American research groups were a huge part of this, and stuff like that. And
well, I mean, you heard me talking about Valet was down there.
Yeah.
Investigation.
And, you know, he was exposed to large doses of radiation and had like radiation sickness when he came back. He's in the middle of farm territory in Brazil. It's not like he was in Nevada, right, in a farm. Then we knew that they were working on shit like way early. You know, it's not like that.
Yeah, I mean that. Well, I mean just the months after all the things that he experienced, you know, in the months after the occurrence, very much points to the kind of things that you have from a radiation sickness type situation. Like you said, what's there that you can get that? You know, we did detonate a lot, like the world detonated a lot of nuclear bombs, you know, in the periods leading up to 1957 and in 1957. And it's very possible that, you know, winds carried radioactive material around the world, and it probably did.
Yep.
So the skeptic says, well, that's where his radioactive, body ailments may have come from. But why didn't his family experience any of it? Why didn't his brother experience any of it? It was really, only him who had these things and had these side effects. So,
yep. Well, thank you for that, Josh. We're going to go ahead and get out of here, though. Thank you so much for all that great information. Next week, we're going to be talking about five lesser known contactees from the 1950s to kind of step away from abduction and more of association. A little bit, still kind of abducted in my opinion, but that's the case it's going to be. But thank you guys so much for tuning into the Convergence Enigma with Josh and Stefan here on the UNX Radio Network, unxnetwork.com, as well as the Fearscape Media Network, fearscapemedia.com. This has been Stefan with a reminder to keep your eyes on the skies, folks.
This has been Josh. The truth is now.
And remember, folks, keep searching, keep questioning. Good night, everybody.
Good night.